From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. What a great program in store for you tonight. Wow. Later tonight, connecting with spirit guides. Here's what's happening. Something's happening out there in space. Sudden shrieks of radio waves from deep space keep slamming into radio telescopes on Earth, spattering these instrument detectors and confusing data. And now the astronomers are using artificial intelligence to try to pinpoint the source of these sounds in the hope of explaining what's sending them to Earth from billions of light years across space. They are baffled. Well, as we've been reporting, North Korea continues testing missiles, playing President Trump for a fool, they say. Let's check in with Charles R. Smith. Is he being played for a fool, Charles?
Nah, this is just more the same. They're actually kind of reacting to the South Korean purchase of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So it's not a real major development. I mean, you're looking at missile launches at about 100 miles and about 300 miles.
Now, you know, one of the things that Kim Jong-un keeps talking about is war games with South Korea and the United States. Now, we basically have stopped the war games, haven't we?
For the most part, exercises have wound down, but there are still exercises that have taken place, in particular exercises with air power and the new F-35As that the South Koreans have purchased.
Well, and I've got to tell you, Charles, the restraint that you said we would put on North Korea is there. We haven't done anything dangerous, nor have they.
Yeah, for the most part, it's been just war words, and for the most part, you're going to be seeing some launches, maybe potential testing. I don't foresee any major, like, nuclear test or an intercontinental ballistic missile test on the horizon yet.
All right, Charles. Charles' website, softwar.net. After a timid start to the Atlantic hurricane season, forecasters are advising that conditions have changed to allow for above normal activity as the peak months now of the season have arrived. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said in its mid-season outlook that an El Nino weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean has ended, leading to neutral conditions that are more favorable for tropical activity. NOAA forecasters are now calling for 10 to 17 named storms with winds of 39 miles an hour or higher, which 5 to 9 of these could strengthen into hurricanes. Of those storms, there will be 2 to 4 major hurricanes, which are classified as Category 3, 4, and 5, with winds of 111 miles per hour or higher. That's dangerous. A major report on land use and climate change says the West's high consumption, that's us, of meat and dairy product is fueling global warming. That's right. The scientists and officials stop short of calling on everyone to become vegans or vegetarians, but they said that more people could be fed using less land if individuals cut down on eating meat. Interesting story there. The recent escalation in the U.S.-China trade war has brought forward the next U.S. recession, according to a majority of economists polled by Reuters, who now expect the Federal Reserve to cut rates again in September and once more next year. Catherine Austin Fitz, of course, predicted the last rate decrease. What do you think about the future, Catherine?
Well, the Fed's probably going to have to cut a little bit more, George. We really see central banks fighting deflation. We had the several central banks lower more than was expected this last week, and it's now got people nervous. So if you look at the futures market, the market expects the Fed to drop by over, the Fed dropped 25 basis points. The market's expecting another 100 basis point drop by next year if you trust the futures market. So there's no doubt about it. Central banks are fighting deflation, and if you think they hate inflation, they really hate deflation because we're choking on debt worldwide, and they need inflation to get that debt covered.
And Catherine, is the economy holding on pretty strongly, or do you think it's on fragile ground here?
So we're rebalancing the China trade, and that's always, we knew that was always going to be uncomfortable. So that's hard because it's shrinking balance sheets globally and it's shrinking cash flow. So it looks like a recession. I think the Fed was responding more to international conditions, but there's no doubt it looks like there's deflation going on in the economy, and it looks like we're headed into a recession, certainly internationally.
What's new with Solari.com, your website?
Well, George, we just published two volumes, The Real Game of Missing Money, on all the issues related to the $21 trillion missing from the federal government and Federal Financial Advisory Standards Board's Statement 56. So we just decided, you know, we've been publishing material on the missing money for many years, but it's really time to get everything collected in one great collection and publish it in a hard copy.
It sure is. Thanks again. Catherine's website, solari.com. Willie Nelson has canceled the remainder of his current tour, citing a health issue. The 86-year-old singer performed the show in Toledo, Ohio, then took to Twitter to tell followers, "I'm sorry to cancel my tour, but I have a breathing problem that I need to have my doctor check out. I'll be back." Falling asleep can feel like an impossible task sometimes, and while some people fall asleep easier than others, everyone experiences the occasional sleepless night. Well, according to a new long-term study, the key to a better night's sleep may just be looking on the bright side of life. Researchers from the University of Illinois say that the more optimistic a person is, the more likely they are to enjoy longer, more restful sleep patterns. How about that? 50 years. It's been 50 years since the horrible Tate LaBianca murders, the Charlie Manson episode. Up next, Iva Davis joins us with his real incredible book, Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. If you were old enough in 1969 to understand these tragic murders we're going to talk about, this will be a riveting experience for you. If you were born way after that and you're not too familiar with this situation, well, you're going to get some great information, too. London-born Iva Davis first came to America in the early 60s and was appointed the West Coast correspondent for the London Daily Express back in 1963. His first big assignment came the following year, to simply hang out, travel with, and get to know those four members of a new pop group from Liverpool called the Beatles. 50 years later, Davis wrote The Beatles and Me on Tour, and over more than five decades as a writer for The Express and The Times of London, Iva covered major events in North America. He penned a weekly entertainment column for the New York Times Syndicate for more than 15 years. In 1969, he co-wrote Five to Die, the first book ever published about the Sharon Tate LaBianca murders, and covered the trial for the Daily Express. His latest work is called Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Iva, welcome to the program. I'm looking forward to this.
Good morning and good evening, whichever, wherever you are.
I was 19 years old when this tragedy occurred, and I was riveted to the television. I couldn't get enough newspaper articles about this unbelievable story. Let's go back just a little bit, Iva, and talk about Charles Manson. He was born in 1934. He probably didn't know who his father was. His mother was jailed. He had a screwed up life from the get-go, didn't he?
He did. And, I mean, many people in the world today had screwed up lives, but some of them came out of it and turned out pretty well. Charles Manson went from bad to worse to killer. So his history is the sort of thing that troubled kids go through, but Manson somehow turned into, you know, this bad penny, putting it mildly. By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, George, but it's kind of eerie that you and I are talking almost 50 years to the moment when Charles Manson sent his killers out from the Spahn Ranch to kill Sharon Tate. I mean, the timing is kind of eerie, I must say. But sorry, go ahead.
What's so freaky about it, Iva, is it might be to the hour 50 years ago that happened.
Yes, I mean, it is pretty well on the button, because I'm very familiar with this because I covered it from day one. And I know that about this time, Manson called them together and said, "Get the black clothing on and head out." And this was it. It's 50 years ago to this moment.
Now, and then Manson, earlier in his life when he was in his 20s, I mean, he got into trouble. He went to jail. He went to jail for a forged check situation. He stole a car. He did some petty things, but he really didn't do the serious stuff until what point?
Well, when he got out of jail, finally, in 1967, he was a con man extraordinaire. He had survived in the prison system, a small guy, a runt of a guy who was threatened by prisoners, and with a smooth tongue and a line of patter, he talked his way out of trouble and stayed in one piece in prison. Now, he got out, and all of a sudden, it was the summer of love, the year of love, sex, drugs, rock and roll, easy sex, and Manson thought he'd landed in paradise. And with his con man skills, he turned it into his own bizarre, awful paradise with girls doing his total, utter bidding.
Now, he wanted to be a musician. He claimed to be a singer-songwriter. And one of the stories that I've heard, and maybe you can corroborate it, Iva, to tell us whether the people who were in the house the night they were murdered were in the wrong place at the wrong time, because weren't there a record producer, didn't they live in that house before in Manson, and they turned down Manson for any kind of possible jobs as a singer-songwriter, and he wanted to get them?
Well, that's the sort of popular story, George, but let me tell you what. I mean, here was the situation. Charles Manson desperately wanted to be a rock star, and in fact, if he'd become a rock star, you and I probably wouldn't be talking at this moment.
That's right.
So Manson had dreams to become a rock star. He met, through Dennis Wilson, the drummer of the Beach Boys, he met Terry Melcher. Terry Melcher was a hot shot record producer with the Byrds and all those groups of the 60s. And Terry Melcher was enamored. Terry Melcher, by the way, was the only son of the late Doris Day. And he was a record producer who had the Byrds and other groups. And Manson met him at the home of Dennis Wilson, because believe it or not, Manson and his girls became palsy-wowsy with Dennis, so much so that Dennis invited Manson and the girls to move into his mansion on Sunset Boulevard. And that became the entree for Charles Manson to meet rock and roll people, including Terry Melcher. And to get down to answer your question, Terry Melcher was kind of attracted to Manson. He liked his lifestyle. He saw that he had these 25 nubile, semi-naked girls doing his total bidding. He wanted to be a rock star. Melcher was looking for some new talent, and Melcher auditioned him, but then went off Manson, and Manson was very upset about that.
In 1969, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, reworked one of Manson's songs called Never Learn Not to Love and put it in an album of called 2020. I got a clip of the Beach Boys doing Manson's song. Here we go. That's the Beach Boys doing the reworked Charles Manson song. Charlie didn't sound like that, Ivor, did he?
No. You know, the interesting story was that, as I mentioned, Charlie was enamored with Dennis Wilson and Wilson with him. And Charlie wrote the song called Cease to Exist. Now, he gave it to Dennis, assuming that Dennis would pay him for it and would record it. But he did record it, as we've just heard. Changed some of the lyrics, changed the title, and the biggest insult to Manson was Manson did not get a credit for it. And Manson was very upset by that. He felt, well, these rock and rollers, they're absolute, you know, you can't trust them. And so that's what happened with Manson, and that's what happened with Dennis Wilson. Dennis Wilson thought, well, you know, I'll take the song, I'll say it's mine. It's kind of repayment for everything I've given to Charlie and how I, I allow Charlie and his girls to run rampant over my house and stuff like that. So Manson didn't think it that way, and he was very upset at Mr. Wilson.
And Dennis, of course, had his own demons, died at the age of 39, drowned after being in some kind of alcoholic stupor, and drowned in Malibu.
He actually drowned in, I mean, I always, it's not very funny, but in the waves of the Marina Del Rey, because there were no waves in the Marina Del Rey. But yeah, he was alcoholically inclined. He was into drugs. He was into sex. I mean, he was also a very troubled soul, a talented, troubled soul.
So when Manson sent his three followers, the two girls and Charles Watson, to that house to commit a crime, to commit murder, who did he think was in the house at the time?
Well, he knew that Melcher wasn't there anymore. But what he decided to do was he sent Charles Tex Watson to the house, because Charles Tex Watson, who was his acolyte, his second in command, he knew the house on Cielo Drive, because he had stayed there. He had overnight. He had dined there. He was familiar with the premises. And Charlie knew he was familiar with the premises and sent Tex out to kill them all and also leave witchy signs. And they did leave witchy signs, because, as some people know, the carnage of killing everybody was absolutely monstrous. But also they wrote messages in the blood of the victims that said helter skelter piggies and stuff like that. And so that was the result of Manson sending them out to the Terry Melcher house. But Terry Melcher, Manson knew, was no longer living there.
Was Manson obsessed with the Beatles?
Manson was obsessed with the Beatles, because what he would do, and I learned this because I went to the Spahn Ranch very soon after the case broke wide open, and I sat there listening to his acolytes who were not involved with the murders, and I was stunned, because I heard, I mean, the message was that Manson made his followers believe that the Beatles' White Album songs like Helter Skelter and Piggies and Revolution were messages, secret messages to Manson, warning him of an upcoming race riot. I mean, where there would be bloodshed, and Manson would then flee to the desert, escape this massive war, and come out at the end of it a free man. I mean, it's all a bit crazy when you put it in the perspective of now, but that's what he made his drug-addled believers and members of the family believe.
We're with Iva Davis. His book, Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Did you ever have an opportunity to interview Charlie Manson in prison?
No, I didn't interview Charlie Manson in prison, but I was sitting about 10 feet away from him, watching him very closely for a year during the trial. And I saw that he was an entertainer. He was a disruptor. He was a bit crazy. And it was a trial like nothing else on earth, because Manson, you didn't know what to expect every day. One day Manson jumped at the judge with a sharp pencil. And
jeez. Said,
"You're going to die, old man." So Manson, I saw his antics. I saw the way he handled the judge. He handled it himself. And then I saw him in interviews, and he was, I mean, gobbledygook and playing the poor, beaten-down man. I mean, he was a great actor. That's about as much as I can say about him.
Why didn't his attorney ever try to get him as, insane?
Well, because all the attorneys for all the girls wanted to go originally on the insanity plea. Manson said no way, and every time a lawyer showed up to say the girls were insane, and some of them were insane, like Leslie Van Houten, Manson said, get rid of the lawyer. Get a lawyer that will go along with our decision to run the case this way. The amazing thing, if I may say, George, is that throughout the one-year trial, Manson and the girls never testified in front of the jury in their own defense. I mean, crazy.
Now, one is still in jail. Atkins, I think, is dead. And Watson, the guy, he's still in jail too, right?
Watson is still in jail. Leslie Van Houten, who took part in only the LaBianca murders, is in jail. She has been recommended for parole by the parole board, but each time the recommendation has been denied by the governor of California. And Patricia Krenwinkle is also in jail. But I don't think, politically and otherwise, they will ever get out, because the crimes are heinous, And there's been a long battle to keep them there, although many people think they've served their time and mercy should be shown.
Not for the way they kill those people, Iva.
Exactly. You've hit the nail on the head.
How did you get involved with this case?
Well, I was a reporter for the London Daily Express, which was a big London newspaper, West Coast correspondent, and they just said, there's been a murder, a series of murders in a Hollywood, Beverly Hills, hilltop mansion. Get out there. And I went out there exactly 50 years ago.
Well, hold on for a second, Iva. We're at a break, but when we come back, tell us what you saw when you got to the scene, and we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with Iva Davis. His book is called Manson Exposed. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Later on in the program, time permitting, I want to talk with him about his book, The Beatles and Me on Tour, as well. So, Iva, when you got to the scene of the murders, of course, the bodies were gone. What did it feel like? What was there?
Well, believe it or not, when I got to the scene of the crime, the bodies were still there. The cops had just arrived.
Oh, my gosh. You got there that fast?
Yes. Oh, yeah, because we knew that there had been murders. And then we all descended, or would say we, the local press, and I descended upon the house. But you've got to remember this, George. Back 50 years ago, we did not have the Internet. I mean, today, as you know, when George sneezes, everybody in Copenhagen hears about it 10
right.
seconds later.
Exactly.
So that's the way it was. Back then, that the communications, I mean, we listened to police radios, we listened to gossip, we gathered at the house. There was a sort of an excitement and yet a little bit of apprehension from everybody because we knew there were corpses. We didn't know who they were. We didn't know it was Sharon Tate. And then when we discovered it was Sharon Tate, we thought Roman Polanski, her husband, was also one of the corpses, but it was not. It was another Polish guy, a friend of Polanski called Wojtek Frykowski. And so what actually happened, it was kind of a fascinating little melting pot. We stood outside and the rumors were flying. I mean, there was some suggestions that drugs had been found. Somebody thought it was a mafia hit. Other people, a drug deal gone wrong. There were some wicked whispers about satanic rituals and all the rest of it. The information was leaking out bit by bit until finally the cops identified all the victims.
And even there was also a person who was visiting his friend who lived in one of the outside houses, a guy named Stephen who got shot to death in his car or something in the beginning.
I mean, this is fate. Horrible, horrible fate. 18-year-old Stephen Parent, who had nothing to do with anybody in the main house, was visiting a friend in the guest house. He was just about to leave in his car when Tex Watson and the killer band of girls showed up at the house. Tex saw him and pumped him with four bullets, killing him, and the guy never knew what was going on. He had nothing to do with anything. At the wrong place at the wrong time, a classic example of that.
Horrible, horrible. And now, after the murders, how did police catch these people, and how did they catch Manson?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because the truth of the matter is this. They captured Manson 4 months only after the murders. For 4 months, Hollywood was in panic. They didn't know who had done it. They didn't realize that their neighborhoods, which were safe, were now crawling with possible killers. And here's how it happened. Susan Atkins was one of the young band of killers that went to the Sharon Tate house. And she was in jail for another murder, the murder of Gary Hinman, which happened actually on July 27th, 1969. Gary Hinman was a very pleasant musician. A music teacher. He cooked up a little bit of drugs when he ran out of cash. And Manson and his pals, called Bobby Beausoleil, went along. Manson ordered Beausoleil to kill Hinman, and Hinman was killed, and Susan Atkins was there. And she was that was why she was in prison, for the murder of Gary Hinman, nothing to do with Sharon Tate. And while she was in jail, she couldn't resist boasting. And she boasted to her cellmates that she'd killed Sharon Tate. They thought she was full of blarney.
Oh.
She wasn't. She spelled out details. The inmates, her cellmates, called the cops. The cops came to interview Susan Atkins, and she told it all. She ended up spilling her guts and then testifying in front of the grand jury. That's exactly how they solved the murders.
Without her talking, they never would have gotten to Manson, would they?
Absolutely. I mean, it's remarkable. Not many people know that, but Susan Atkins' big mouth led to what we're talking about.
Wow. What was Manson like in his years later? Was he still kind of whacked out?
I think he was whacked out, but look, he was in prison for life. He knew he was never, ever going to get out. And as a result, you know, he manipulated the prison system as much as he could. And what happened, and you may remember this, was that every week for about 20 years, Diane Sawyer, Tom Snyder, Ron Reagan Jr., Geraldo Rivera showed up with cameras in prison, and Charlie Manson had his new moment in the sun. I mean, he entertained, and you and I could sit in the safety of our living rooms and watch Charlie Manson, the bogeyman, perform. And that's what he did. He was very good at that. I mean, and when I looked at all the interviews, Manson was entertaining. I mean, it's crazy, but that's how his popularity grew out of control.
I'll always remember his eyes, this cold, stark look of his eyes.
Yes, you're right. And the thing about those eyes were they could kind of pierce you, because I can tell you, sitting in the courthouse, in the courtroom for a year, I saw him fix those kind of laser eyes on people. And people kind of knew they were burning into them. And Manson kind of did that as a game. You know, he kind of gave them the evil gaze, and they either looked away or they shouted. I mean, it was crazy, but that's what he liked to do, play games.
Here we are 50 years later, and this case is still being discussed much more than anything other than the Kennedy assassination. How come?
Well, because, as I mentioned, Manson, to some extent, became a media idol. They loved him on the primetime television. And there was, you know, if he had been executed as was planned, we wouldn't be talking about it. But he managed to keep himself with his devoted girls hanging around the courtrooms and hanging around the prisons in the public eye. And everybody is fascinated with the morbidity of the case.
And 50 years later, you come out with another book called Manson Exposed. Tell me, what compelled you to write it?
Well, I'll tell you exactly. 2 years ago, I was visiting my daughter in the Pacific Northwest, and I met two young men who were remodeling her kitchen. And they sat down with me and had a cup of coffee, and I asked them what they knew about crime, and we talked about crime. I said, what about Charles Manson? And one of the guys said to me, oh, Manson, yeah, he's the ecologist. He's the environmental guy who the government railroaded with a phony murder charge. And this was their vision of Charles Manson. I thought, oh, my God, if these guys think this, there must be millions or thousands of people who think Manson was innocent. And Manson was not innocent.
Had you been able to interview him, what would you have asked him?
Well, I would have tried to ask him why he sent them out to murder Sharon and all the others. But I in a way, I instinctively knew that I would be the object and the target of Manson's gobbledygook, his trash talking, he almost spoke a different language, and I knew I wouldn't get the straight answer, because when he did get a chance to talk to people with good sense, he tried to bamboozle them with all sorts of craziness, and I don't regret not talking to him, because everybody I've spoken to who has spoken to him said that Charlie tried to manipulate you. And that's what I found would have happened. I did end up talking to scores of people who knew him, who were in jail with him, who were his prison guards, who were his lawyers. And they told me the same thing, because don't forget, I watched Manson up close and personal almost for nearly a year. And I knew what kind of jiggery pokery he would get up to.
6 years after the horrible murders of Tate and LaBianca, and I want to ask you about the LaBiancas in a moment, there was a woman who was part of the Manson family called Lynette Squeaky Fromm, who tried to assassinate President Gerald Ford in 1975. You had some kind of situation with her? What happened?
I did. Now, Squeaky was one of the Manson devotees, and today she's still a Manson devotee, believe it or not. She's not a young girl. She's a slightly older woman.
And she's in prison for life, too, right?
No. Lynn Squeaky Fromm, what happened was, if I may just capsulize it. At the first day of the trial, I saw Lynn, and she knew that I was not a Manson fan.
She was released 10 years ago.
Yes, she was released 10 years ago.
Okay.
For trying to assassinate Gerald Ford. I mean, it's amazing, but there it is. She got out on parole, and she's still around. And, you know, when I met her before she tried to assassinate Gerald Ford, she said to me, and she knew I didn't like Manson, here's what she said. She said, "Ivor, do you know what it feels like to have a sharp knife slip down your throat?"
Jeez.
Well, I took that as a threat.
Of course. How could they parole her after she attempted to kill a president?
I don't know. I mean, there is something about the legal, you know, the sentence she got. But she is out, and she is probably listening to this show and saying,
I'm going to slit your throat again.
Pardon?
She wants to slit your throat again.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe. And but I want to tell you, George, that many of the Manson devotees who were not in jail tried to murder other people who were anti Charles Manson, particularly those who testified in the trial against Manson. Strange things happen. One guy called Paul Watkins woke up in his trailer and he was burning because by accident, he claimed, somebody had set fire to the trailer. Another girl who was going to testify against Manson went to Hawaii and was given 10 tabs of LSD in a hamburger. She survived.
Oh, my God.
So those things, the tentacles of Manson stretched far and wide, even though Manson was behind bars.
Was he trying to create a race war?
He thought there would be a race war. He was very, very racist himself. I think he was anti-everything, establishment, anti-Semitic, anti-whatever you want to say, anti-the establishment. And the whole race war thing, I think, was a bit of an exaggeration. But, I mean, the reason I think he sent his people out to murder was to get his pal Bobby Beausoleil off the hook for the murder of Gary Hinman on July 27th, 1969, which was ordered by Manson. It's a sort of complex little network of Charlie saying, "We're going to do two other murders, and we're going to make it look like a band of black militants killed these people, and my friend Bobby Beausoleil would then be set free from prison." And I mean, it's simple warped thinking that in today's light makes absolutely no sense.
And Ivor, wasn't Manson obsessed with biblical prophecy?
Yes, he was obsessed with biblical prophecy, and he actually preached at the Spahn Movie Ranch to his devotees that the four horsemen of the apocalypse were four guys with breastplates, which could be guitars,
mm-hmm.
long hair, which could be mophead people, and of course, they were the Beatles. I mean, again, in today's cool, clarified light of history, it sounds absolute poppycock, as we used to say, and it was poppycock, but the devotees and the Manson family members believed that kind of stuff. From Manson, they believed anything.
Let's talk about your book, The Beatles and Me on Tour. That must have been a fascinating time for you.
Well, I was very lucky to get the assignment because the Beatles at that time in 1964 were just coming to the front in America. And some of your listeners out there may remember a guy called Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, that's right. He's the one who put him on the map here.
He did it. He did with his magic. He got them on the show, and they were a sensation. 74 million people tuned into that show. Well, as soon as the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, learned that, he said, "Boys, we're going to America." And they came to America in August 1964, and they were sensations because I was there for every concert. I was there for the Bedlam. I mean, you could never hear a single song because there were all these girls screaming. But the Beatles were a huge draw, and they made a lot of money, and they were a great success. And that they went on to even more fame. But that was the Beatles in America in 1964.
I used to do Ed Sullivan impressions as a kid. And I would do that right here on our stage, the Beatles.
Very good. Yeah. I love that. I love that.
But I remember watching that show, and these people went, the teenage girls went crazy when they would take shots of them in the studio.
Yeah, do you remember, I'm sorry, I've got to ask you, because you're so good at doing Ed, remember how we, can you give me, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles?
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
Very good. Okay, top of the class.
But, yeah, he had that Sunday night television show, and he had it for years until his ratings started to go. But
you know, George, I've got to ask you this. I mean, when I came from England, I mean, he was a bit like a traffic cop. I mean, what was the magic of Ed Sullivan? That why was he so popular?
Well, a couple things were happening during that time period. Television was relatively in its infancy. Most of his shows were black and white, if not all of them. And he was a newspaper columnist, so he had a big name in this country.
Yes.
And at that time, a lot of people migrated either from the newspapers or from radio into network television. And you'll notice most of them were older white guys who would probably not make it in today's demographic world. I mean, you look at Bob Hope and Jack Benny, and I mean, they were all older white guys. I mean, nowadays it would be very competitive for an older person like that to succeed on television. Sadly to say, but it's true.
Yeah, well, the other interesting thing was that Brian Epstein, the manager of the Beatles, knew that if he got his boys on Ed's show, it would be the magic passport to success. And he was right.
Yes.
Because you know, the 74 million people and Ed's show, and that would pave the way. It paved the way for the Beatles' enormous success in America and the rest of the world.
I remember kids in our school class starting to grow their hair. Parents would go nuts. It was a phenom. A moment that I'll never forget. And their music was, you know what? I like their music. I still like it.
Their music is so phenomenal now. I mean, kids, my kids, my grandkids, they know the Beatles music. And it's really remarkable that they've crossed so many generations.
You know, our big group here in the United States at the time, they were the Beach Boys, who Charlie Manson had an affinity for. A friend of mine discovered them. He just passed a couple of years ago, Russ Regan.
Oh,
and at the time, they were called the Pendletons, which was a shirt. They named themselves after a shirt. And he heard that name and said, no. You're in California. Yeah. You're going to be called the Beach Boys. And they said, okay, Russ, that's what we'll be. And that's how it started for them.
Yeah. You know, I must tell you, you bring up Russ Regan because he is in my book. And the story, do I have time to tell you the story about Russ Regan?
We've got a minute. Can you do it in a minute?
Yes,
if not, we'll do it when we come back.
35 seconds.
All right. Go for it.
There was a guy that was in prison who recommended Charlie Manson to go to Universal Studios to do a recording audition. He went to Universal Studios. The guy there liked him and called Russ Regan and said, you've got to test these guys. You've got to record these guys. Russ Regan recorded the Manson and his girls, and then when Manson and his girls were arrested and charged with murder, poor Russ Regan went into sort of fits because he thought, my God, I'm hooked up to the Manson gang. And I think he got rid of the recordings. But Russ had terrific recording people under his umbrella.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story, too. About 4 years ago, before Russ passed on, he let us play one of Charlie Manson's songs with Charlie singing it on Coast to Coast on this radio show. And he wasn't really a talented guy at all, Manson. But we heard it, and we had to give Russ back the CD. But it was an amazing moment. We're going to come back, Iva, and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.